Good afternoon. My name is Lindsay, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Religious Freedom Under Siege, Why Zubik v. Burwell Matter. All reporter lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you, Ms. Sarah Ratcliffe. You may begin your conference.
Thank you, Lindsay, and welcome everyone. Good afternoon, and thank you for joining today's press conference call. As she said, the title of our call is Religious Freedom Under Siege and Why the Zubik v. Burwell Cases Matter, featuring members from the Coalition for Liberty and Justice. My name is Sarah Hutchinson Ratcliffe. I'm the Domestic Program Director for Catholics for Choice. And today we'll hear from four other leaders with member organizations of the Coalition for Liberty and Justice: Bridget Amiri, Senior Staff Attorney for the ACLU; the Reverend Barry Lynn, Executive Director of Americans United for the Separation of Church and State; Anne-Marie Benitez, Senior Director of Government Relations for the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health; and Ray Carey, Executive Director for the National LGBTQ Task Force. The Coalition for Liberty and Justice is a diverse coalition of groups dedicated to women's rights, social justice, separation of church and state, religious freedom, reproductive rights and justice, and LGBT rights. Though diverse in issue focus, organizational goals, and ideologies, we come together, 60 members strong, united in the belief that religious liberty is a right too precious to allow it to be warped into the means to discriminate against others. We come together because we care about real religious freedom. This Wednesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a set of cases that we believe could spell the end of religious liberty as we know it in the United States. A brief summary of how we got here. The Affordable Care Act, as many of you, I'm sure, remember, requires no cost coverage for preventive care, including contraceptive care. In the law, originally, houses of worship were exempted from providing this particular coverage. Later, the Obama administration, in answer to demands from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops and other allies, devised an opt-out for religiously affiliated organizations that object to this coverage. That included filling out a form to declare their objection, and then the coverage is to be provided directly to employees and students through a third-party administrator. The 2014 Hobby Lobby decision at the Supreme Court suggested that for-profit companies that object on religious grounds should also be provided an opt-out. And later, the federal government provided this by extending this so-called accommodation for the opt-out to for-profit corporations. Plaintiffs in the cases on Wednesday, the Zubik cases, claim that their religious rights are being violated by this accommodation. And they're challenging the law, asking that the original exemption for houses of worship be expanded to include all institutions that have religious objections to the coverage. The cases, which are seven cases consolidated under Zubik v. Burwell, were brought by Bishop David Zubik of Pittsburgh and leaders of six other religiously affiliated organizations. But they're not just about the Affordable Care Act, nor about objections to providing birth control coverage. These cases represent a profoundly harmful interpretation of religious freedom. The coalition of voices that we represent here today are deeply concerned about what could happen if the court rules in favor of the outrageous idea that employers should be allowed to trample on the consciences and personal lives of employees. Basically, in the debate surrounding these lawsuits, there are two sides. One, led by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops and its allies, has vocally attempted to cast contraceptive coverage as an affront to religious liberty, the liberty of the employers, and specifically, the employers like them. The other side, represented by those speaking today and many more partners and members of the Coalition for Liberty and Justice, firmly believe the contraceptive coverage benefit upholds women's religious freedom, and that the definition of religious freedom itself is at risk in the debate created by these latest cases in the bishop's ongoing battle to get special rights and not have to play by the same rules as everyone else. I'd like to turn to our speakers now. First up, we'll hear more about what these cases could mean and about the legal issues at stake. Bridget Amiri from the ACLU. Bridget, go ahead.
Thanks so much, Sarah, and thank you so much to everyone for joining the call today. So I'd like to just talk a little bit about the legal background of the case and how we got here and what this case is going to decide. I'll back up by talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is the federal statute that's being used in these cases by the plaintiffs to argue that they get out from underneath the requirement of filling out this opt-out form. And then we'll talk about Hobby Lobby, and we'll talk a little bit more about Zubik itself. So the claim that the court will hear in these cases is not a constitutional one. Instead, it's based on the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA, which is a federal statute that prohibits the federal government from substantially burdening religious beliefs unless there's a compelling government reason for doing so, and there isn't another way for the government to achieve its goals without burdening religious beliefs. So broken down, there are basically three prongs to the RFRA test. The first is the government substantially burdening religious beliefs? And I want to pause there for a minute because the word substantial was explicitly inserted in the bill to modify the word burden. So minimal burdens on religion do not rise to the level of a substantial burden under RFRA. I'd also like to pause to say that the sincerity of religious beliefs is a different inquiry than whether a law objectively substantially burdens religious beliefs. So there's no question as to the sincerity of the religious beliefs of the plaintiffs in these cases. However, it's up to the court to have an objective inquiry as to whether the law substantially burdens those religious beliefs. The second prong of the RFRA test is if the government is substantially burdening religious beliefs, is there a compelling government interest that satisfies that burden, that justifies that burden? And the third prong is, if so, is the challenge law the least restrictive means of accomplishing that government's goal? Or in other words, is there another way that the government could achieve its compelling interest in a way that doesn't burden religion or burdens it less? So those are the three RFRA prongs. So how is this applied in the Hobby Lobby case? 2 years ago, the Supreme Court decided Hobby Lobby, as you all know, a case brought by an arts and crafts giant, along with other for-profit corporations, sued under RFRA because they objected to covering all or some forms of contraception because of their religious beliefs. In June 2014, in a 5-4 decision, the court ruled in favor of Hobby Lobby. We obviously think the court got it wrong, but that opinion is very relevant to the discussion that the court will hear on Wednesday in the Zubik case. So under Hobby Lobby, the court found that there was a substantial burden on Hobby Lobby's religious beliefs for having to pay for coverage for medical care with which they disagreed. We think that the court gave short shrift to the objective inquiry that I mentioned before about whether there was a substantial burden. And so the court unfortunately found that the Hobby Lobby's religious beliefs were substantially burdened by having to provide contraception coverage to their employees. And so therefore the court went on to the next prong of the RFRA test, which is whether there's a compelling government interest to justify that burden. The Hobby Lobby majority assumed, without deciding, that there was a compelling government interest in promoting women's health and promoting women's equality. And the last prong of the RFRA test is the law the least restrictive means of achieving the government's interest? So again, is there another way for the government to achieve its goals without burdening religion or burdening less? And this is where the discussion of the accommodation comes in, as Sarah was talking about. So the accommodation or this opt-out process was already available to nonprofit organizations at the time that Hobby Lobby was decided. And the Supreme Court, the majority in Hobby Lobby, looked to that accommodation to see whether there was a least restrictive means for the government to both achieve its goals and to not burden religion. And the majority said, and I quote, "We therefore conclude that this system," the one that was being challenged, constitutes an alternative, we can therefore conclude that this system, meaning the accommodation, constitutes an alternative that achieves all of the government's aims while providing greater respect for religious liberty. The court went on to say that the effect of the HHS-created accommodation on the women employed by Hobby Lobby and the other companies involved in these cases would be precisely zero. So the court in Hobby Lobby specifically looked to this accommodation or opt-out when deciding whether the Hobby Lobby's religious beliefs were burdened, and they pointed to the accommodation as another way that the government could achieve their goals to ensure that women get contraception coverage, but that religious beliefs were not burdened or burdened less. But as Hobby Lobby was working its way up the courts, there were these other cases brought by the nonprofits challenging that very accommodation. So far, 9 courts of appeals have issued rulings on whether this accommodation violates RFRA, and all but one found in favor of the government. All of 8 courts of appeals have found that there is no substantial burden on religious beliefs by filling out a form and essentially opting out of covering contraception. The court has taken 7 cases and consolidated them. They're holding others until after a decision in Zubik. And as Sarah mentioned, the employers in these cases are arguing that filling out the opt-out form violates their religious beliefs. In their mind, by filling out that form, it would facilitate coverage for contraception in their employees' health plan. But as numerous courts have recognized, it's not the form that triggers the coverage, it's the Affordable Care Act. The Affordable Care Act requires health plans to cover contraception, full stop. If a religious employer does not want to provide coverage, then it can opt out by filling out the form. The insurance company then provides contraception coverage in a separate plan. So basically, what these employers are trying to do is block contraception coverage for their employees. We don't think there's a substantial burden on religious beliefs from having to fill out a form. But even if there was, there's a compelling government interest in ensuring that women have seamless access to birth control, both in terms of women's health and women's equality. Contraception provides numerous health benefits, including for non-contraceptive purposes, and also for women's equality. Contraception is incredibly important. Women must be able to decide whether and when to become a parent in order to be equal participants in society. And even if there was a substantial burden, and the court has already recognized that the government has a compelling interest, the court has hopefully already signaled that the accommodation is the least restrictive means of achieving the government's goal. And that's why we are hopeful that the court will find in favor of the government in these cases. Oral argument is Wednesday, March 23rd. A decision will be expected by the end of June. Other speakers will talk about what's at stake in these cases. But I just want to say that really what's at stake is whether tens of thousands of employees will have to literally pay for their employer's religious beliefs. And with that, I'll turn it back to Sarah.
Thanks, Bridget, I appreciate that. I'm just gonna take a few moments and talk a bit more about the Catholic perspective, both of organizations that disagree with those who are challenging this law, and about what Catholics believe across the country. As Bridget said, this is only the latest Supreme Court case to challenge the implementation of the no-cost birth control benefit in the Affordable Care Act. But contrary to what those behind these ongoing challenges would have you believe, this case is not just about access to contraception, nor is it solely about the definition of religious freedom in this country. Catholic healthcare and nonprofits that provide social services are big businesses, both domestically and abroad, and the bishops are trying to protect their multi-million dollar interests. If the court decides for Zubik, 5,800 Catholic nonprofit organizations could subject their employees to this exclusion of benefit. It could be disastrous for the hundreds of thousands of employees at the Catholic nonprofit organizations, such as the Catholic elementary and high schools that together employ 163,000 lay teachers, or their colleagues at the 233 Catholic colleges and universities. We'll hear more about universities from Barry in just a moment. But the loss of benefits to these employees and their students could be tremendous. For the 639 Catholic hospitals that employ nearly 750,000 full and part-time workers, None of these numbers take into account the workers who are also employed at the 438 Catholic ancillary systems, medical centers, sanatoriums, hospices, and, as I said, other social service agencies. And while the plaintiffs in the cases claim that filing a form or another declaration with the government indicates that their objection to the contraceptive coverage violates their religious freedom under RFRA, but boiled down, what they really are seeking is a complete exemption, which means leaving their employees and their dependents without access to these critical health services entirely. It's clear that the litigation is actually about controlling the behavior of people who work at these employers, about imposing one set of moral views on others, and even if it disregards the will of the individuals who work at these institutions. At Catholics for Choice, we know that the majority of the 70-plus million Catholics in the United States are not represented when the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops war on religious liberty rights for workers, for women, and LGBT people. The vast majority of Catholics in this country support contraceptive coverage and oppose carve-outs that allow discrimination. Not surprising when you know that 99% of sexually active Catholic women in the United States have used a form of birth control that the bishops disapprove. 63% of Catholic voters nationwide believe that insurance plans, whether they're public or private, should cover contraception. And 68% of Catholics believe that religiously affiliated organizations like universities should not be allowed to deny their students or employees birth control coverage. When Catholics for Choice joined 9 of our Catholic organizational partners to file an amicus brief, we asked the court to consider both the reproductive rights and religious freedoms of the individuals at religious institutions, the workers, the employees, their dependents. If the court decides in favor of these plaintiffs, the individuals who will be harmed are these workers. They'll be left out of the critical contraception, and if the decision is against the government, much like the workers at the diocese, parishes, synagogues, and other entities that fall under the exemption. These include workers at the 17,700 Catholic parishes across the United States, again, who probably employ thousands of workers. Our brief argued that the bishops and their allies have no right to impose their religious beliefs on their employers and on their employees and dependents, whether they're Catholic or not. This decision would cause harm to the vast majority of Catholics who disagree with the bishops on matters of reproductive health, and specifically on the moral use of contraception and the fairness of providing access to insurance coverage benefits that are provided for all who need it as a matter of social justice. At Catholics for Choice, we believe it is unjust to allow any employer, university administration, hospital CEO, to trample on the conscience rights of workers, students, or patients. It's insulting to mistake something so blatantly discriminatory, so clearly restrictive of some people's consciences, for freedom. Catholics believe that human dignity is not something that's earned by the size of one's paycheck or where that paycheck comes from, but simply by virtue of being human. Catholics believe that women's consciences deserve respect and that individual people, not institutions, have religious liberty rights. It is unconscionable that any woman's religious liberty and rights to human dignity and access to the health care she needs should be left up to anyone but her own conscience. While some Catholic-affiliated organizations are claiming that their freedom to serve is jeopardized by their objection to providing contraceptive coverage, the real story is that these institutions are endangering the health and conscience rights of the people who serve them, their employees, their students, and their families. We'll hear a bit more about the students now from Barry Lynn with the Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, who will give us a sense about why this case matters and discuss AU's representation of students. Barry?
Thank you very much. As both a minister and a lawyer, it's very hard for me to believe that even a single federal appeals court accepted the argument that preparing a written notice of conscientious objection to providing contraceptive insurance and then dropping that into a mailbox could substantially violate anyone's religious liberty under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. In fact, normally, people with sincere objections to a law requiring them to perform an action are happy to have a way to declare their opposition and to assert the morality of that opposition. In comparison, say, to seeking exemption from the military draft, which required a voluminous personal statement of why one sought it, submitting a simple form to the government, asserting your moral objection, is a genuinely trivial feat. The organizations that are plaintiffs in the case to be heard on Wednesday are essentially making the claim that providing any notice implicates the institution in an act of evil, because after they do so, then third parties will provide contraceptive coverage to affected women. This absurd attempt to control other people's behavior cannot be recognized in a structured legal system. I was very glad that Americans United was the one group that managed to intervene directly in a case similar to those that will be heard on Wednesday, in that case on behalf of students at Notre Dame University. We represented the claims of real people whose poignant, vital stories could sometimes be lost in the technical, ethereal arguments about the language of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Regrettably, the actions of Notre Dame in filing endless motions to delay consideration of their case meant that it was not ripe for consideration at the time of the seven cases that we'll hear on Wednesday. A feeling as we do that the voices of real people need to be heard, though, our current and former Notre Dame clients, along with 237 other students, faculty, and staff at religiously affiliated universities, are represented in our amicus brief submitted to the Supreme Court. The trivial nature of the organization's arguments to be heard on Wednesday is crushed by the values of providing contraceptive services to the tens of thousands of women who would be affected directly and immediately by the wrong decision. One of our concerns is that if Priests for Life, Little Sisters of the Poor, Home for the Aged, and others prevail, then more religiously affiliated entities and even more for-profit companies will take the hardline stance of no contraceptive coverage, even if someone else is providing it. There's no doubt in my mind that under the constraints of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, several things are true. First, the government does have a genuinely compelling interest in ensuring access to contraceptive coverage. This coverage reduces the rates of unintended pregnancy, 42% of which we know end in abortion. And by the way, I find it very hypocritical of these organizations to refuse to take moral responsibility for those abortions which they claim to abhor. It's also clear that contraceptive coverage expands women's educational and professional opportunities. Many of the women that we are representing in the amicus brief have submitted detailed explanations of this. There are hosts of statistics to demonstrate that women with unintended pregnancies are less likely to finish college, that if contraceptive availability does allow those women to go to college, failing to provide it makes it more difficult for them to continue in education to obtain advanced professional degrees. Notwithstanding provisions of federal law that seem to preclude discriminatory treatment of pregnant women, religious universities routinely receive waivers from such requirements. And finally, as another compelling interest, it's certainly clear that contraceptive availability significantly improves the health of women. Contraceptive use is linked to smaller families, to longer birth intervals, a host of other factors that lead to improvements in infant, child, and maternal health. Contraceptives also protect the health of women with medical conditions for which pregnancy is contraindicated and indeed are used to treat or ameliorate medical conditions totally unrelated to pregnancy protection. I just want to conclude with one observation. The debate over contraceptive coverage has been colored for years by the efforts of political figures and some in the media to confuse the public about what is even at stake here. Nowhere is this as obvious as in the coverage of the case of Little Sisters of the Poor. This is a group that, in fact, runs a national chain of nursing homes. The background role in virtually every depiction of this organization shows nuns aiding elderly women in wheelchairs. That undoubtedly occurs, but the vast majority of caregivers are low-wage women workers for whom the cost of effective contraception is significant in their family's overall budget. To hear some on the right discuss this, however, might make an observer conclude that President Obama is forcing nuns at gunpoint to use birth control. Dynamics on the Supreme Court have obviously changed dramatically since the Hobby Lobby decision last year. This leaves me with a guarded optimism that this time the court will get it right, reject the phony claims of religious liberty, protect access to contraceptives for American women who need it and who deserve it.
Thank you, Barry, very much. Now we want to expand a bit on Barry's remarks and delve into some of the ways that we believe a decision for these plaintiffs would harm women and why exclusions that are being sought are specifically a threat to the equality, dignity, and liberty of women of color. Anne Marie Benitez with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Anne Marie Benitez, and I am the Senior Director of Government Relations at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. As the only national organization representing 26 million Latinas, we believe that healthcare is a basic human right. In that vein, access to contraception is an essential part of that care and is essential to ensuring the health, dignity, and economic security of all people, particularly for Latinas and women of color. Contraception allows individuals to plan their families and their futures, and Latinas agree strongly. The overwhelming majority of Latinas, including Latinas of faith, use contraception. In fact, 97% of Latinas who have ever had sex have used some form of contraception. Furthermore, when you break that down, 95% of married Catholic Latinas use modern contraception. Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, many people of color have access to preventive health services without copay, including coverage of contraceptive care. However, some people of color are still not able to access this care, and Zubik threatens to compound existing barriers to care. This case would create one more barrier to care for communities who already have little access to health services, including Latinas, immigrant women, and low-income population who live in states who have refused to expand Medicaid. Latinas often face employment with low wages and less job flexibility, which can make accessing contraception without seamless coverage all the more difficult. According to National Women's Law Center, nearly half of the women in low-wage workforces are women of color. We should continue to build on the gains of the Affordable Care Act to ensure that all individuals, regardless of income or immigration status, have access to the full range of quality, affordable, reproductive health services and coverage without the interference of their employees. Thank you very much, and I turn it back to you, Sarah. Thank you.
Thank you, Anne Marie. Finally, we want to move to hear a bit more about how this case is about far more than just birth control and access to contraception, as important as that is. Ray Carey of the National LGBTQ Task Force will review how this decision could undermine civil rights and specifically LGBTQ rights. Ray?
Thank you. Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. The task force is especially interested in this case because of the significant impact it would have on LGBTQ people and our families. Many of us can get pregnant, including cisgender women, transgender men, those who are intersex, gender nonconforming people. Many LGBTQ people can get pregnant and need affordable access to birth control and other reproductive health options to make the best decisions for ourselves. This case is also about our families. Even for those who aren't likely to use birth control or can't get pregnant, they still benefit from having birth control coverage in this way. For example, Obamacare lets children up to the age of 26 get coverage under their parents' health insurance plans. But if the court sides with the employers in this case, it would mean that a gay couple's college-age daughter couldn't get birth control coverage through either of her dad's health plans if one of their employers makes a religious objection. The task force understands how important it is to preserve true religious freedom in this country. Many LGBTQ people and our friends and family are people of faith. But using faith to deny other people access to health care is not religious freedom. We strongly believe that our ability to control our sexual and reproductive health should not depend on the religious beliefs of our employers. If employers can actually use religion to deny their workers birth control coverage in this case, it would set an incredibly dangerous precedent. The slippery slope implications are concerning. For example, employers could also refuse to cover drugs like PrEP because it's been successfully used to reduce HIV transmission rates among gay and bisexual men if that goes against the employer's religious beliefs. Combined with other so-called religious freedom laws that are creeping up across the country, it's not hard to imagine a case where a doctor refuses to treat a transgender woman with breast cancer by making a religious exemption. LGBTQ people can't afford this growing trend of religious exemptions, and we can't afford to have the highest court of the land condone them. Many of the people who try to restrict reproductive health decisions are the same people and entities who want to control what we as LGBTQ people do with our bodies and our access to health care. It is why we stand shoulder to shoulder with our colleagues in the reproductive rights movement in ensuring access to health care, including contraception. Thank you.
Thank you, Ray. We really appreciate it. Want to thank Bridget, Barry, Anne-Marie, and Ray. Now we'll open up the call for questions for members of the press. Lindsay, do you have a question for us?
Certainly. And at this time, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And we do have a question from the line of Molly Redden with The Guardian. Your line is now open.
So one thing I've heard, attorneys on the opposing side say is that the government's position is weakened by the fact that they've given out so many exemptions already to patients under grandfathered plans, workers, and people who work for religious institutions. And so I'm curious to hear you guys' response to that.
This is Sarah Radcliffe. I think I'll take my first stab at it and open up to any of the other speakers who'd like to address it. We certainly at Catholics for Choice believe that the exemption, the original exemption for houses of worship, left out a large number of folks and the employees and workers who work for those institutions as well. We believe that the benefit is one that is important to be provided to everyone. And frankly, we agree that the exemptions are not necessary. The fact that these cases are trying to expand that exemption to include even more folks who will be left out completely from even the possibility of getting this coverage from a third-party administrator is very concerning to us. Bridget, or?
Yeah, this is Bridget. I'll also add to that. So in terms of one of the things that the other side has pointed to try to claim that the government doesn't have a compelling interest is the fact that the Affordable Care Act doesn't apply to small businesses. Mm-hmm. And so that's also would be true of Title VII, which prohibits discrimination based on sex and race and other protected classes in the workplace. Title VII doesn't apply to small employers with less than 15 employees. And so we would never say that Title VII, which does all of these amazing things to protect workers from discrimination, is somehow invalid or improper simply because small businesses aren't covered. And with grandfathered plans, those are plans that will gradually come into compliance with the ACA as changes are made to the plan. So all of those plans will also eventually cover contraception as well. And with the houses of worship, the federal government made a decision to exempt them from the requirements of the contraception rule based on the idea that they employ people of the same faith and serve people of the same faith, which is not true of the religiously affiliated nonprofit organizations, which employ people of all different faiths or no faith at all, and serve people of the general public. So I don't think that their argument has much weight.
Great, thanks.
Thanks, Bridget. Another question?
Our next question comes from the line of Paige Cooperstein. Please state your media outlet or your organization. Your line is now open.
Hi, I'm Paige from Philadelphia Gay News. I was wondering, how will the outcome of the Zubik case impact anti-LGBT religious freedom bills that are passing in state legislatures, like the one in Georgia?
Barry or Ray, would you want to take that?
Ray, you want to do this?
Sure, I'll briefly say, you know, what we know from the past is that when Hobby Lobby was decided, immediately, in fact, within the next 24 hours, we saw repercussions for the LGBTQ movement nationally, where a set of pastors wrote to President Obama asking him to include a broader religious exemption in the then upcoming executive order banning discrimination by federal contractors. We also saw over this last year in places like Indiana, echoes of Hobby Lobby and specific references to Hobby Lobby when state legislators were talking about discriminatory laws that they wanted to pass that would have discriminate against LGBTQ people. So what we know from the past is that there are a number of state legislators that do take their cue from what happens in the Supreme Court and on the federal level, which is one of the reasons why this case is of great concern to our community.
You know, this is Barry. Let me just add, two quick points. The Hobby Lobby decision, if extended and expanded by the decision in Zubik, would stand for the proposition that with the only exceptions that we know of based on the language in the Hobby Lobby decision, only failure to pay taxes or actual engagement in race-based discrimination could not be trumped by a religious claim. So were Zubik to move in the wrong direction, I think would only enlighten the unenlightened people who are attempting to pass these provisions at the state level to make a claim that they can, in fact, use religion as a basis to be excused from anything that they do not like. And we have, at Americans United, created a project, and you can go to the protectthyneighbor.com, and it's updated twice a week to look at these kinds of legislative enactments or attempted enactments throughout the United States.
Thank you very much. Do we have another question?
Our next question comes from the line of Patty Miller with Religion Dispatches. Your line is now open.
Hi, Patty Miller with Religion Dispatches. I'm just curious. It seems like this is getting a lot less attention than Hobby Lobby. But in some ways, the implications are larger, not just for the contraceptive mandate, but for really any of the religious freedom issues that are out there right now. Because the way I look at it, it would prevent the government from even creating workable workarounds. If no one has to tell the government that they want to opt out of something, it basically makes it impossible to have any kind of seamless workaround for the employers or for students or in any other case where a religious freedom claim would be put forth. Is that the right impression that I have?
This is Sarah Radcliffe. I certainly think, and I'll ask if anyone else wants to take this, I think we certainly see this as a very dangerous, and although the precedent setting that the for-profit exemption in Hobby Lobby set, this, as you said, really does have wide-reaching goals because it does open the door for many, many more challenges to and objections to services or the kinds of people that folks didn't agree with or the lifestyles that folks have lived or the way that they believe, that employers believe their employees should live their lives. We at Catholics for Choice certainly disagree that when you take a job, that employer then gets to decide all of the things that your conscience should lead you to, including how and when you form your families, whether or not to use reproductive health care services, and whether or not to support things politically. That is what we see as the danger of this door being opened, and we hope very strongly that the Supreme Court will see it that way as well and stop it.
Patty, I do think that there were a lot of articles written at Hobby Lobby based on statements made by Justice Kennedy. And with Justice Scalia's death, I think there is less attention paid to this, perhaps, because there is a sense of inevitability, which I do not share, but a sense of inevitability that he will see this accommodation as sufficiently reasonable to meet any test. But I think that that's possibly the reason for a lack of interest in comparison to the volumes of interest in Hobby Lobby.
Bridget, Anne-Marie, Ray?
Yeah, this is Bridget. I will just chime in and say, you know, Sarah ended her remarks to that question with, and I just want to echo and share, is that we are extremely optimistic that the court will find in favor of the government in these cases if it's going to hold true to what it said in Hobby Lobby. So the majority in Hobby Lobby, written by Justice Alito, pointed specifically to this accommodation as a way that employees could both get the coverage that they were entitled to receive under law and that this accommodation wouldn't burden religious beliefs. And so if there is adherence to that statement in the majority opinion in Hobby Lobby, then we should see a clear victory in June.
Great. Thanks, Bridget. Lindsay, do we have another call? We'll take maybe time for one more, two more.
Our next question comes from the line of John Riley with Metro Weekly. Your line is now open.
Hi, all. I was just wondering, in terms of the legal ramifications, what would a 4-4 split decision do since there was a split among the circuits? So what would be the impact of a 4-4 decision?
So this is Bridget. All of the cases coming from the courts of appeals that were taken by the Supreme Court, so the Supreme Court consolidated 7 cases that they're hearing on Wednesday. In all of those cases, the government prevailed below. So a 4-4 split would affirm the victories in the lower courts. The one courts of appeals that went against the government, the Eighth Circuit, there is a cert petition pending. And so there's a possibility that that cert petition could then be taken by a new court in a new term. And so that's one scenario. But as I said before, I'm extremely optimistic for not a split, and in fact, a clear victory.
Understand.
Great. Lindsay, I think we have time for one more question. Do we have another?
Our next question comes from the line of Molly Redden with The Guardian. Your line is now open.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking a second. I'm just wondering, functionally, what would happen if these groups were not required to notify the government whether or not they were covering contraception, because, you know, in the case of houses of worship, I assume that the government just assumes that none of them are and third-party administrators should be stepping up in all cases. But would this one create a problem for figuring out in which cases insurers and third-party administrators needed to intervene?
This is Sarah with Catholics for Choice. I mean, my understanding, and Bridget or others correct me if I'm mistaken, but my understanding is in the exempted religious institutions, the houses of worship, those employees do not get contraceptive coverage. There is no provision. That's why the declaration needs to happen, so that the third-party administrator can be informed that they have to provide the coverage directly. So if Zubik, if the court decides for Zubik and these organizations that object are allowed to be exempted completely, not declare their or not fill out the form or not explain that they have an objection, the employees will be left completely without the benefit.
Yeah, and this is Bridget. I mean, it's an interesting question about kind of what happens on the ground, and I'm not sure we have complete clarity as to this, but the default under the Affordable Care Act, for fully insured plans at least, is that the Affordable Care Act requires those insured plans to cover contraception. The opt-out form is a way for the employer to say that we don't want to have to cover contraception, and insurance company, you provide that benefit instead. So in some ways, because the default is for fully insured plans at least is to cover contraception, if the nonprofit organizations that are objecting that have fully insured plans did nothing, I wonder whether their insurance coverage for contraception would just be covered. But that's the interesting thing, is that they're not just saying that they don't want to have to fill out the form. They are saying that they want to prohibit the federal government from requiring the employee's insurance company from covering contraception. So it's a twofold objection, both as to filling out the form and then telling the government that they don't want the government to require their insurance cover to cover contraception, because that is the default.
So I want to be cognizant of folks' time and say thank you very much to all of our speakers once again, Bridget Amiri, Barry Lynn, Anne-Marie Benitez, and Ray Carey for their remarks, and for the participants for being on the call. Thank you, everyone, for joining this important conversation. I think as reflected by the speakers on today's call, the representing groups are dedicated to women's rights, social justice, separation of church and state, reproductive rights and justice, and LGBT rights. The Coalition for Liberty Justice is a broad-based alliance of organizations, as evidenced by some of these few members here of today. The coalition will work together and individually to ensure that public policy protects the religious liberty of individuals of all faiths and of no faith, and to oppose public policies that impose one religious viewpoint on all. We are united in our strong conviction that this is the case, that this case is vitally important to the future of our nation and religious liberty as we know it. We believe that current efforts to redefine religious liberty as a means to discriminate are wrong. And together, we will continue to fight for the right of each person to have freedom of religion and freedom from religion being imposed upon them. We thank you all for your time today and hope that you'll keep asking questions as the cases move forward. Thank you.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.